Chapter 3. High Concept, High Touch. Think of the last 150 years as a three-act drama. In Act 1, the Industrial Age, massive factories and efficient assembly lines powered the economy. The lead character in this act was the mass production worker, whose cardinal traits were physical strength and personal fortitude. In Act 2, the Information Age, the United States and other nations began to evolve. Mass production faded into the background, while information and knowledge fueled the economies of the developed world. The central figure in this act was the knowledge worker, whose defining characteristic was proficiency in L-directed thinking. Now, as the forces of abundance, Asia, and automation deepen and intensify, the curtain is rising on Act 3. Call this act the Conceptual Age. The main characters now are the creator and the empathizer, whose distinctive ability is mastery of R-directed thinking. To compress a few hundred years of economic history into a couple of sentences, we've progressed from a society of farmers to a society of factory workers to a society of knowledge workers. And now we're progressing yet again to a society of creators and empathizers, of pattern recognizers and meaning makers. Or return to our metaphor. We've moved from an economy built on people's backs to an economy built on people's left brains to what is emerging today, an economy and society built more and more on people's right brains. When economies and societies depended on factories and mass production, R-directed thinking was mostly irrelevant. Then, as we moved to knowledge work, R-directed thinking came to be recognized as legitimate, though still secondary, to the preferred mode of L-directed thinking. Now, as North America, Western Europe, Australia, and Japan evolve once again, R-directed thinking is beginning to achieve social and economic parity, and in many cases, primacy. In the 21st century, it has become the first among equals, the key to professional achievement and personal satisfaction. But let me be clear. The future is not some Manichaean world in which individuals are either left-brained and extinct or right-brained and ecstatic, a land in which millionaire potters drive BMWs and computer programmers scrub counters at Chick-fil-A. L-directed thinking remains indispensable. It's just no longer sufficient. In the conceptual age, what we need instead is a whole new mind. High concept and high touch. To survive in this age, individuals and organizations must examine what they're doing to earn a living and ask themselves three questions. 1. Can someone overseas do it cheaper? 2. Can a computer do it faster? 3. Is what I'm offering in demand in an age of abundance? Mere survival today depends on being able to do something that overseas knowledge workers can't do cheaper, that powerful computers can't do faster, and that satisfies one of the non-material transcendent desires of an abundant age. That is why high-tech is no longer enough. We'll need to supplement our well-developed high-tech abilities with abilities that are high-concept and high-touch. As I mentioned in the introduction, high-concept involves the ability to create artistic and emotional beauty, to detect patterns and opportunities, to craft a satisfying narrative, and to combine seemingly unrelated ideas into a novel invention. High touch involves the ability to empathize, to understand the subtleties of human interaction, to find joy in oneself and to elicit it in others, and to stretch beyond the quotidian in pursuit of purpose and meaning. High concept and high touch are on the rise throughout the world economy and society. But for the most persuasive evidence, it helps to look in the most unlikely places. Take medical schools, long a bastion for those with the best grades, highest test scores, and the keenest powers of analytical thinking. Today, the curriculum at American medical schools is undergoing its greatest change in a generation. Students at Columbia University Medical School and elsewhere are being trained in narrative medicine because research has revealed that despite the power of computer diagnostics, an important part of a diagnosis is contained in a patient's story. At the Yale School of Medicine, students are honing their powers of observation at the Yale Center for British Art, because students who study paintings excel at noticing subtle details about a patient's condition. Meantime, more than 50 medical schools across the United States have incorporated spirituality into their coursework. UCLA Medical School has established a hospital overnight program in which second-year students are admitted to the hospital overnight with fictitious ailments. The purpose of this play acting? To develop medical students' empathy for patients, says the school. Jefferson Medical School in Philadelphia has even developed a new measure of physician effectiveness, an empathy index. Or leave American teaching hospitals and head for the world's second-largest economy, Japan, which rose from the ashes of World War II thanks to its intense emphasis on L-directed thinking, is now reconsidering the source of its national strength. Although Japanese students lead the world in math and science scores, many in Japan suspect that the nation's unrelenting focus on schoolbook academics might be an outdated approach. So the country is remaking its vaunted education system to foster greater creativity, artistry, and play. Little wonder, Japan's most lucrative export these days isn't autos or electronics. It's pop culture. Meanwhile, in response to the mind-melting academic pressures on Japanese youth, the education ministry has been pushing students to reflect on the meaning and mission of their lives, encouraging what it calls education of the heart. Then, when you've returned from Japan, check out a third unlikely setting, the mammoth multinational General Motors. A few years ago, GM hired a man named Robert Lutz to help turn around the ailing automaker. Bob Lutz is not exactly a touchy-feely, artsy-fartsy kind of guy. He's a craggy, white-haired man in his 70s. During his career, he's been an executive at each of the big three American automakers. He looks and acts like a Marine, which he once was. He smokes cigars. He flies his own plane. Until recently, he believed global warming was a myth peddled by the environmental movement. But when Lutz took over his post at beleaguered GM, and the New York Times asked him how his approach would differ from that of his predecessors, here's how he responded. It's more right brain. I see us being in the art business. Art, entertainment, and mobile sculpture, which coincidentally also happens to provide transportation. Let that comment settle in for a moment. General Motors, an exemplar not even of the information age, but of the industrial age, says it's in the art business. The art business. And the person leading GM into this right-brain world isn't some beret-topped artiste, but a 70-something piss-and-vinegar former Marine. To paraphrase Buffalo Springfield, there's something happening here, and what it is becoming more clear. High concept and high touch aptitudes are moving from the periphery of our lives to the center. MBAs and MFAs. Getting admitted to Harvard Business School is a cinch. At least that's what several hundred people must think each year after they apply to the graduate program of the UCLA Department of Art and don't get in. While Harvard's MBA program admits about 10% of its applicants, UCLA's Fine Arts Graduate School admits only 3%. Why? A Master of Fine Arts, an MFA, is now one of the hottest credentials in a world where even General Motors is in the art business. Corporate recruiters have begun visiting the top arts grad schools, places such as the Rhode Island School of Design, the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, Michigan's Cranbrook Academy of Art, in search of talent. And this broadened approach has often come at the expense of more traditional business graduates. For instance, in 1993, 61% of management consultancy McKinsey's recruits had MBA degrees. Less than a decade later, it was down to 43%. Because McKinsey says other disciplines are just as valuable in helping new hires perform well at the firm. With applications climbing, and ever more arts grads occupying key corporate positions, the rules have changed. The MFA is the new MBA. The reasons for this go back to two of the forces I explained in the previous part of this audiobook. Because of Asia, many MBA graduates are becoming this century's blue-collar workers, people who entered a workforce full of promise only to see their jobs move overseas. Investment banks, as we learned, are hiring MBAs in India to handle financial analysis. A.T. Kearney estimates that in the next 5 years, U.S. financial services companies will transfer 500,000 jobs to low-cost locales such as India. As The Economist magazine puts it, the sorts of entry-level MBA tasks that once would have been foisted on ambitious but inexperienced young recruits working long hours to earn their spurs in Wall Street or in the City of London are, thanks to the miracle of fiber optic cable, foisted on their lower-paid Indian counterparts. At the same time, because of abundance, businesses are realizing that the only way to differentiate their goods and services in today's overstocked marketplace is to make their offerings physically beautiful and emotionally compelling. Thus, the high concept abilities of an artist are often more valuable than the easily replicated L-directed skills of an entry-level business graduate. In the midst of the last century, Charlie Wilson, a GM executive who became U.S. Defense Secretary, famously remarked that what was good for General Motors was good for America. It's time to update Wilson's maxim for a new century. What is happening to General Motors is happening to America, and what is happening to America is happening in many other countries. Today, we're all in the art business. In the United States, the number of graphic designers has increased tenfold in a decade. Graphic designers outnumber chemical engineers by 4-1. Since 1970, the United States has 30% more people earning a living as writers and 50% more earning a living by composing or performing music. Some 240 U.S. universities have established creative writing MFA programs, up from fewer than 20 two decades ago. More Americans today work in arts, entertainment, and design than work as lawyers, accountants, and auditors. In 2002, urban planner Richard Florida, then at Carnegie Mellon University, identified a group of 38 million Americans that he labeled the creative class and claimed were the key to economic development. Although Florida's definition of creative was bizarrely expansive, he includes accountants, insurance adjusters, and tax attorneys as creatives. The growth of this class's ranks is hard to ignore. Its share of the U.S. workforce has doubled since 1980 and is 10 times what it was a century ago. A similar trend toward high-concept work is afoot elsewhere in the world. Using a more sensible definition of creative, to include 15 industries from design to performing arts to research and development to video games, British analyst John Hawkins estimates that the creative sector in the United Kingdom is producing nearly $200 billion of goods and services each year. Hawkins calculates that within 15 years, this sector will be worth about $6.1 trillion internationally, making High Concept Nation one of the largest economies in the world. Meantime, British organizations such as the London Business School and the Yorkshire Water Company have established artist-in-residence programs. Unilever UK employs painters, poets, and comic book creators to inspire the rest of its staff. One North London football club even has its own poet-in-residence. But art in the traditional sense is neither the only nor the most important component of these emerging whole-minded aptitudes. Go back to those information age rock stars, computer programmers. The outsourcing of routine software work is putting a new premium on software engineers with high concept abilities. As the Lalits and Riteshes of the world take over the routine work of software fabrication, maintenance, testing, and upgrading, conceptual age software types will concentrate on novelty and nuance. After all, before the Indian programmers have something to fabricate, maintain, test, or upgrade, that something must first be imagined or invented. And these creations must then be explained and tailored to customers and entered into the swirl of commerce, all of which require aptitudes that can't be reduced to a set of rules on a spec sheet. Ingenuity, personal rapport, and gut instinct. IQ and EQ. When museum curators of the future assemble an exhibit on American schooling in the 20th century, they'll have many artifacts to choose from. Chunky textbooks, dusty blackboards, one-piece injection-molded desks with wraparound writing surfaces. But one item deserves special consideration. I recommend that in the center of the exhibition, enclosed in a sparkling glass case, the curators display a well-sharpened number 2 pencil. If the global supply chain ever confronted a shortage of number 2 pencils, the American education system might collapse. From the time children are able even to grasp one of these wooden writing sticks, they use them to take an endless battery of tests that purport to measure their current ability and future potential. In elementary school, we assess children's IQ. Later on, we measure their skill in reading and math, then plot their scores against children from the rest of the state, the country, and the world. By the time kids arrive in high school, they're preparing for the SAT, the desert they must cross to reach the promised land of a good job and a happy life. As I've noted, this SATocracy has its virtues. But America's test-happy system also has several weaknesses that are only recently being acknowledged. For example, Daniel Goleman, author of the groundbreaking book Emotional Intelligence, has examined an array of academic studies that have attempted to measure how much IQ, which, like the SAT, measures pure L-directed thinking prowess, accounts for career success. What do you think these studies found? Here's a one-question quiz. You don't even need a number two pencil. According to the latest research, IQ accounts for what portion of career success? A, 50 to 60% of career success. B, 35 to 45%. C, 23 to 29%. D, 15 to 20%. The answer? Between 4 and 10%. Confining oneself only to the answers presented is a symptom of excessive L-directed thinking. According to Goleman, IQ can influence the profession one enters. My IQ, for instance, is way too low for a career in astrophysics. But within a profession, mastery of L-directed thinking matters relatively little. More important are qualities that are tougher to quantify. The very kinds of high concept and high touch abilities I've been mentioning. Imagination, joyfulness, and social dexterity. For instance, research by Goleman and the Hay Group has found that within organizations, the most effective leaders were funny. That is, funny haha, not funny strange. These leaders had their charges laughing three times more often than their managerial counterparts. And humor, as I'll discuss a bit later in this audiobook, depends heavily on the brain's right hemisphere. But where have you seen a standardized test that measures comedic aptitude? Actually, you could find one in New Haven, Connecticut, where a Yale University psychology professor developed an alternative SAT. Professor Robert Sternberg, who recently moved from Yale to Tufts University, calls his test the Rainbow Project. And it certainly sounds like a lot more fun than the pressure-packed exam many of us endured as teenagers. In Sternberg's test, students are given five blank New Yorker magazine cartoons and must craft humorous captions for each one. They must also write or narrate a story, using as their guide only a title supplied by the test givers. Sample title, The Octopus's Sneakers. And students are presented with various real-life challenges, arriving at a party where they don't know anybody, or trying to convince friends to help move furniture, and asked how they'd respond. Although still in its experimental stages, the Rainbow Project has been twice as successful as the SAT in predicting how well students perform in college. What's more, the persistent gap in performance between white students and racial minorities evident on the SAT narrows considerably on this test. Sternberg's test doesn't aim to replace the SAT, only to augment it. In fact, one of its funders is the College Board, which sponsors the SAT. And the SAT itself recently has been revised to include a writing component. But the Rainbow Project's very existence is revealing. If you don't do well on the SAT, Sternberg says, everywhere you turn, the access routes to success in our society are blocked. But as more educators are recognizing, those roadblocks can exclude people with aptitudes the SAT doesn't measure. This is especially true for high-touch abilities, that is, the capacity for compassion, care, and uplift, which are becoming a key component of many occupations in the conceptual age. The number of jobs in the caring professions, counseling, nursing, and hands-on health assistance is surging. For example, while advanced nations are exporting high-tech computer programming jobs, they are importing nurses from the Philippines and other Asian countries. As a result of this shortage, nursing salaries are climbing, and the number of male registered nurses has doubled since the mid-1980s. Money and meaning. While work is going high concept and high touch, the most significant change of the conceptual age might be occurring outside the office and inside our hearts and souls. Pursuits devoted to meaning and transcendence, for instance, are now as mainstream as a double tall latte. In the United States, 10 million adults now engage in some form of regular meditation, double the number a decade ago. 15 million practice yoga, twice the number in 1999. American popular entertainment is so awash in spiritual themes that TV Guide magazine heralds the rise of transcendental television. The aging of U.S. baby boomers, as well as the even more notable aging of the populations of Japan and the European Union, is accelerating this shift. As people mature, writes psychologist David Wolf, their cognitive patterns become less abstract, left brain orientation, and more concrete, right brain orientation, which results in a sharpened sense of reality, increased capacity for emotion, and enhancement of their sense of connectedness. In other words, as individuals age, they place greater emphasis in their own lives on qualities they might have neglected in the rush to build careers and raise families: purpose, intrinsic motivation, and meaning. Indeed, two researchers have argued that this fleet of empathic, meaning-seeking boomers has already started wading ashore. In 2000, Paul Ray and Sherry Ruth Anderson identified a subculture of 50 million Americans that they dubbed cultural creatives. Cultural creatives, they claim, account for one-fourth of U.S. adults, a population roughly the size of France. And the attributes of this cohort echo many of the elements of an R-directed approach to life. For instance, cultural creatives insist on seeing the big picture, the authors write. They are good at synthesizing. And they see women's ways of knowing as valid, feeling empathy and sympathy for others, taking the viewpoint of the one who speaks, seeing personal experiences and first-person stories as important ways of learning, and embracing an ethic of caring. Baby boomers are entering the conceptual age with one eye on their own chronological age. They recognize that they now have more of their lives behind them than ahead of them, and such indisputable arithmetic can concentrate the mind. After decades of pursuing riches, wealth seems less alluring. For them, and for many others in this new era, meaning is the new money. What does all this mean for you and me? How can we prepare ourselves for the conceptual age? On one level, the answer is straightforward. In a world tossed by abundance, Asia, and automation, in which L-directed thinking remains necessary but no longer sufficient, we must become proficient in R-directed thinking and master aptitudes that are high concept and high touch. We must perform work that overseas knowledge workers can't do cheaper, that computers can't do faster, and that satisfies the aesthetic, emotional, and spiritual demands of a prosperous time. But on another level, that answer is inadequate. What exactly are we supposed to do? I've spent the last few years investigating that question, and I've distilled the answer to six specific, high-concept and high-touch aptitudes that have become essential in this new era. I call these aptitudes the six senses: design, story, symphony, empathy, play, meaning. And it is to helping you understand and master these six aptitudes that I devote the second part of this audiobook. Part 2: The Six Senses. Introducing the six senses. In the conceptual age, we will need to complement our L-directed reasoning by mastering six essential R-directed aptitudes. Together, these six high-concept, high-touch senses can help develop the whole new mind this new era demands. 1. Not just function, but also design. It's no longer sufficient to create a product, a service, an experience, or a lifestyle that's merely functional. Today, it's economically crucial and personally rewarding to create something that is also beautiful, whimsical, or emotionally engaging. 2. Not just argument, but also story. When our lives are brimming with information and data, it's not enough to marshal an effective argument. Someone, somewhere, will inevitably track down a counterpoint to rebut your point. The essence of persuasion, communication, and self-understanding has become the ability also to fashion a compelling narrative. 3. Not just focus, but also symphony. Much of the industrial and information ages required focus and specialization. But as white-collar work gets routed to Asia and reduced to software, there's a new premium on the opposite aptitude, putting the pieces together, or what I call symphony. What's in greatest demand today isn't analysis, but synthesis. Seeing the big picture, crossing boundaries, and being able to combine disparate pieces into an arresting new whole. 4. Not just logic, but also empathy. The capacity for logical thought is one of the things that makes us human. But in a world of ubiquitous information and advanced analytic tools, logic alone won't do. What will distinguish those who thrive will be their ability to understand what makes their fellow woman or man tick, to forge relationships, and to care for others. 5. Not just seriousness, but also play. Ample evidence points to the enormous health and professional benefits of laughter, lightheartedness, games, and humor. There is a time to be serious, of course, but too much sobriety can be bad for your career and worse for your general well-being. In the conceptual age, in work and in life, we all need to play. 6. Not just accumulation, but also meaning. We live in a world of breathtaking material plenty that has freed hundreds of millions of people from day-to-day struggles and liberated us to pursue more significant desires, purpose, transcendence, and spiritual fulfillment. Design, story, symphony, empathy, play, meaning. These six senses increasingly will guide our lives and shape our world. Many of you no doubt welcome such a change. But to some of you, this vision might seem dreadful. A hostile takeover of normal life by a band of posers in black unitards who will leave behind the insufficiently arty and emotive. Fear not. The high concept, high touch abilities that now matter most are fundamentally human attributes. After all, back on the savannah, our cave person ancestors weren't taking SATs or plugging numbers into spreadsheets, but they were telling stories, demonstrating empathy, and designing innovations. These abilities have always comprised part of what it means to be human, but after a few generations in the information age, these muscles have atrophied. The challenge is to work them back into shape. That's the idea behind the portfolio section at the end of each chapter. This collection of tools, exercises, and further reading materials will send you on your way to developing a whole new mind. Anyone can master the six conceptual age senses, but those who master them first will have a huge advantage. So let's get started. Chapter 4, Design. The late Gordon McKenzie, a longtime creative force at Hallmark Cards, once told a story that quickly entered the folklore among designers. McKenzie was a public-spirited fellow who often visited schools to talk about his profession. He'd open each talk by telling students he was an artist. Then he'd look around the classroom, notice the artwork on the walls, and wonder aloud who created the masterpieces. "How many artists are there in the room?" McKenzie would ask. "Would you please raise your hands?" The responses always followed the same pattern. In kindergarten and first grade classes, every kid thrust a hand in the air. In second grade classes, about 3/4 of kids raised their hands, though less eagerly. In third grade, only a few children held up their hands. And by sixth grade, not a single hand went up. The kids just looked around to see if anybody else in the class would admit to what they'd now learned was deviant behavior. Designers and other creative types repeated McKenzie's tale, often over drinks, usually in a wistful tone, to show how little the wider world valued their work. And when McKenzie related the story himself to large audiences, people would slowly shake their heads. "What a shame," they would mutter. "Too bad," they would cluck. But their reaction was at most a lament. In fact, they should have been outraged. They should have raced to their local school and demanded an explanation. They should have consoled their children, confronted the principal, and ousted the school board. Because Mackenzie's story is not some teary saga about underfunded art programs, it is a cautionary tale for our times. The wealth of nations and the well-being of individuals now depend on having artists in the room. In a world enriched by abundance but disrupted by the automation and outsourcing of white-collar work, everyone, regardless of profession, must cultivate an artistic sensibility. We may not all be Dalí or Degas, but today, we all must be designers. It's easy to dismiss design, to relegate it to mere ornament, the prettifying of places and objects to disguise their banality. But that is a serious misunderstanding of what design is and why it matters, especially now. John Heskett, a scholar of the subject, explains it well. Design, stripped to its essence, can be defined as the human nature to shape and make our environment in ways without precedent in nature, to serve our needs, and to give meaning to our lives. Look around the room you're in or the vehicle in which you're riding. Everything in your midst has been designed. The clothes that cover your body, the seat in which you're sitting, the building that might surround you, these things are part of your life because someone else imagined them and brought them into being. Design is a classic whole-minded aptitude. It is, to borrow Heskett's terms, a combination of utility and significance. A graphic designer must whip up a brochure that is easy to read. That's utility. But at its most effective, her brochure must also transmit ideas or emotions that the words themselves cannot convey. That's significance. A furniture designer must craft a table that stands up properly and supports its weight. That's utility. But the table must also possess an aesthetic appeal that transcends functionality. That's significance. Utility is akin to L-directed thinking. Significance is akin to R-directed thinking. And as with those two thinking styles, today utility has become widespread, inexpensive, and relatively easy to achieve, which has increased the value of significance. Design, that is, utility enhanced by significance, has become an essential aptitude for personal fulfillment and professional success for at least three reasons. First, thanks to rising prosperity and advancing technology, good design is now more accessible than ever, which allows more people to partake in its pleasures and become connoisseurs of what was once specialized knowledge. Second, in an age of material abundance, design has become crucial for most modern businesses as a means of differentiation and a way to create new markets. Third, as more people develop a design sensibility, we'll increasingly be able to deploy design for its ultimate purpose, changing the world. I saw all three of these reasons converge one brisk February morning, half a block from Independence Hall in downtown Philadelphia, at a place that Gordon Mackenzie must be smiling down on from heaven. It's 10 a.m. in Mike Reingold's design studio. As soothing music is piped through the air, one student is posing on a chair that sits atop a table, while her 19 classmates sketch her form on their large drawing pads. The scene is straight out of a Tony Arts Academy, except for one thing. The young men and women sketching away are all 10th graders, and most of them come from some of the roughest neighborhoods in Philadelphia. Welcome to CHAD, the Charter High School for Architecture and Design, a tuition-free Philadelphia public school that is demonstrating the power of design to expand young minds while also puncturing the myth that design is the province of a select few. Before they came to CHAD as 9th graders, most of these students had never taken an art class, and one-third read and did math at a third grade level. But now, if they follow the route of those in the senior class, 80% of them will go on to 2 or 4 year colleges, and some of them will enroll at places like the Pratt Institute and the Rhode Island School of Design. When it was founded in 1999 as the country's first public high school with a design-centered curriculum, CHAD's goal wasn't merely to train a new generation of designers and to diversify a largely white profession. 3 out of 4 CHAD students are African American, 88% are racial minorities. The aim was also to use design to teach core academic subjects, Students here spend 100 minutes each day in a design studio. They take courses in architecture, industrial design, color theory, and painting. But equally important, the school marries design to math, science, English, social studies, and other subjects. For example, when they study the Roman Empire, rather than only read about the Roman water delivery process, the students build a model aqueduct. They're learning to bring disparate things together to a solution. That's what designers do, says Claire Gallagher, a former architect who previously served as the school's supervisor of curriculum and instruction. Design is interdisciplinary. We're producing people who can think holistically. One student who has flourished in this whole-minded atmosphere is Sean Canty, a junior. He's a smart, skinny kid who is as poised as a veteran designer, yet as gangly as a typical 16-year-old. When I talk to him after classes let out, he tells me that in his rough-and-tumble middle school, I was the kid who always sketched in class. I was the kid who was always good in art class. But you're always the oddball because the artistic person in the classroom is the weird one. Since enrolling as a freshman, he has found his comfort zone and gained a range of experience unusual for someone his age. He interns 2 afternoons a week at a local architecture firm. He's traveled to New York to design a poster with the help of an architect mentor he met through Chad. He's built models of what he calls 2 cool towers he'd like to see constructed one day. Yet Canty says the most important thing he's learned at Chad is broader than any particular skill. I've learned how to work with people and how to be inspired by other people. Indeed, merely walking the halls here is inspiring. Student artwork is on display in the lobby. The hallways sport furniture donated by the Cooper Hewitt Museum. And throughout the school are the works of designers such as Karen Rashid, Kate Spade, and Frank Geary, some of which are presented in lockers Chad students have converted into display cases. The students all wear blue button-down shirts and tan pants. The boys also wear ties. They feel and look like young architects and designers, the school's development director, Barbara Chandler Allen, tells me. No small feat in a school where a substantial portion of the student body is eligible for free lunches. For many of the students, the school is a haven in a harsh world, a place that's safe and orderly, and where adults care and have high expectations. While the typical Philadelphia public high school has a daily attendance rate of 63%, at Chad, it's 95%. Equally revealing is what isn't here. Chad is one of the only high schools in Philadelphia without metal detectors. Instead, when students, teachers, and visitors pass through the front door on Sansom Street, they're greeted by a colorful mural crafted by the American minimalist Saul LeWitt. Although Chad is a pioneer, it is not the only school of its kind. Miami's public school system boasts Design and Architecture Senior High. New York City has the High School of Art and Design. Washington, D.C. has a charter elementary school called the Studio School, where many of the teachers are professional artists. And beyond the elementary and secondary level, design education is positively booming. In the United States, as we learned earlier, the MFA is becoming the new MBA. In the United Kingdom, the number of design students climbed 35% between 1995 and 2002. In Asia, the sum total of design schools in Japan, South Korea, and Singapore 35 years ago was 0. Today, the 3 countries have more than 23 design schools among them. At these schools, as at Chad, many students ultimately might not become professional designers. That's fine, says Deputy Principal Christina Alvarez. We're building an awareness in students of what design is and how it can affect their lives, she tells me. I see the design curriculum as providing a modern version of a liberal arts education for these kids. No matter what path these students pursue, their experience at this school will enhance their ability to solve problems, understand others, and appreciate the world around them. Essential abilities in the conceptual age. The democracy of design. Frank Nuovo is one of the world's best-known industrial designers. If you use a Nokia mobile phone, chances are good Nuovo helped design it. But as a younger man, Nuovo had a difficult time explaining his career choice to his family. When I told my father I wanted to be a designer, he said, "What does that mean?" Nuovo told me in an interview. We need to reduce the nervousness surrounding design, Nuovo says. Design in its simplest form is the activity of creating solutions. Design is something that everyone does every day. From the moment some guy in a loincloth scraped a rock against a piece of flint to create an arrowhead, human beings have been designers. Even when our ancestors were roaming the savanna, our species has always harbored an innate desire for novelty and beauty. Yet for much of history, design was often reserved for the elite, who had the money to afford such frivolity and the time to enjoy it. The rest of us might occasionally dip our toes into significance, but mostly we stayed at the utility end of the pool. In the last few decades, however, that has begun to change. Design has become democratized. Here's an example. You can probably distinguish between the font Helvetica and the font Times New Roman. But if I had asked you to do that, say, 25 years ago, you probably wouldn't have had a clue about what I was even asking. Back then, fonts were the specialized domain of typesetters and graphic designers, something that regular folks like you and me scarcely recognized and barely understood. Today, we live and work in a new habitat. Most Westerners who can read, write, and use a computer are also literate in fonts. If you are a native of the rainforest, you learn to distinguish many sorts of leaves, says Virginia Pastrell. We learn to distinguish many different typefaces. Fonts, of course, are just one aspect of the democratization of design. One of the most successful retail ventures of the last decade is Design Within Reach, a network of 31 studios whose mission is to bring great design to the masses. In DWR's studios and catalogs are the sorts of beautiful chairs, lamps, and desks that the wealthy have always purchased, but that are now available to wider segments of the population. Target, a family visit to which I described earlier, has gone even further in democratizing design, often obliterating the distinction between high fashion and mass merchandise, as it has with its Isaac Mizrahi clothing line. In the pages of the New York Times, Target advertises its $3.49 Philippe Starck spill-proof baby cup, alongside ads for $5,000 Concord La Scala watches and $30,000 Harry Winston diamond rings. Likewise, Michael Graves, whose cerulean toilet brush I purchased during that Target trip, now sells kits that buyers can use to construct stylish gazebos, studios, and porches. Graves, who has designed libraries, museums, and multi-million-dollar homes, is too expensive for most of us to hire to build out the family room. But for $10,000, we might be able to buy one of his Graves pavilions and enjoy the beauty and grace of one of the world's finest architects, literally, in our own backyard. The mainstreaming of design has infiltrated beyond the commercial realm. It's no surprise that Sony has 400 in-house designers, but how about this? There are 60 designers on the staff of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And while God is bringing artists into the room, Uncle Sam is redoing the room itself. The General Services Administration, which oversees the construction of U.S. government buildings, has a design excellence program that aims to turn drab federal facilities into places more pleasant to work in and more beautiful to view. Even U.S. diplomats have responded to the age's new imperatives. In 2004, the U.S. State Department declared that it was abandoning the font it had used for years, Courier New 12, and replacing it with a new standard font that would henceforth be required in all documents, Times New Roman 14. The internal memorandum announcing the change explained that the Times New Roman font takes up almost exactly the same area on the page as Courier New 12 while offering a crisper, cleaner, more modern look. What was more remarkable than the change itself, and what would have been unthinkable had the change occurred a generation ago, was that everybody in the State Department understood what the memo was talking about. Design means business. Business means design. The democratization of design has altered the competitive logic of business. companies traditionally have competed on price or quality or some combination of the two. But today, decent quality and reasonable price have become merely table stakes in the business game, the entry ticket for being allowed into the marketplace. Once companies satisfy those requirements, they are left to compete less on functional or financial qualities and more on ineffable qualities such as whimsy, beauty, and meaning. This insight isn't terribly new. Tom Peters, whom I quoted earlier, was making the business case for design before most business people knew the difference between Charles Ames and Charlie's Angels. Design, Peters advises companies, is the principal difference between love and hate. But as with the State Department's font memo, what's remarkable about the business urgency of design isn't so much the idea, but how widely held it has become. Consider two men from separate countries in different worlds. Paul Thompson is the director of the Cooper Hewitt Museum in New York City. Norio Ohga is the former chairman of the high-tech powerhouse, Sony. Here's Thompson. Manufacturers have begun to recognize that we can't compete with the pricing structure and labor costs of the Far East. So how can we compete? It has to be with design. Here's Ohga. At Sony, we assume that all products of our competitors have basically the same technology, price, performance, and features. Design is the only thing that differentiates one product from another in the marketplace. Thompson's and Ohga's arguments are increasingly borne out on corporate income statements and stock tables. For every percent of sales invested in product design, a company's sales and profits rise by an average of 3 to 4%, according to research at the London Business School. Similarly, other research has shown that the stocks of companies that place a heavy emphasis on design outperform the stocks of their less design-centric counterparts by a wide margin. Cars are a good example. As I noted earlier, the United States now has more autos than drivers, which means that the vast majority of Americans who want a car can have one. That ubiquity has brought down prices and boosted quality, leaving design as a key criterion for consumer decisions. U.S. automakers have slowly learned this lesson. For a long time, going back to the 1960s, marketing directors were more focused on science and engineering, gathering data and crunching numbers, and they neglected the importance of the other side of the brain, the right side, says Ann Asenio, a design director for GM. And that eventually proved disastrous for Detroit. It took mavericks like Bob Lutz, whom we heard from earlier, to show that utility requires significance. Lutz famously declared that GM was in the art business and worked to make designers the equals of engineers. You need to differentiate or you cannot survive, says Asenio. I think designers have a sixth sense, an antenna, that allows them to accomplish this better than other professionals. Other car companies have shifted gears and headed in this same direction. BMW's Chris Bangle says, we don't make automobiles. BMW makes moving works of art that express the driver's love of quality. One Ford vice president says that in the past it was all about a big V8. Now it's about harmony and balance. So frenzied are the car companies to differentiate by design that in Detroit's macho culture, horsepower has taken a backseat to ambience, as Newsweek puts it. The Detroit Auto Show might as well be renamed the Detroit Interior Decorating Show. Your kitchen offers further evidence of the new premium on design. We see it, of course, in those high-end kitchens with gleaming sub-zero refrigerators and gargantuan Viking ranges. But the phenomenon is most evident in the smaller, less expensive goods that populate the cabinets and countertops of the United States and Europe. Take the popularity of Q-tensils, kitchen utensils that have been given personality implants. Open the drawer in an American or European home, and you'll likely find a bottle opener that looks like a smiling cat, a spaghetti spoon that grins at you and the pasta, or a vegetable brush with googly eyes and spindly legs. Or just go shopping for a toaster. You'll have a hard time finding a plain old model because most of the choices these days are stylized, funky, fanciful, sleek, or some other adjective not commonly associated with small appliances. Some pundits might write off these developments as mass manipulation by wily marketers or further proof that well-off Westerners are mesmerized by style over substance. But that view misreads economic reality and human aspiration. Ponder that humble toaster. The typical person uses a toaster at most 15 minutes a day. The remaining 1,425 minutes of the day, the toaster is on display. In other words, 1% of the toaster's time is devoted to utility, while 99% is devoted to significance. Why shouldn't it be beautiful, especially when you can buy a good-looking one for less than 40 bucks? Ralph Waldo Emerson said that if you built a better mousetrap, the world would beat a path to your door. But in an age of abundance, nobody will come knocking unless your better mousetrap also appeals to the right side of the brain. Design has become an essential aptitude because of the quickened metabolism of commerce. Today's products make the journey from L-directed utility to R-directed significance in the blink of an eye. Think about cell phones. In less than a decade, they've gone from being a luxury for some to being a necessity for most to becoming an accessorized expression of individuality for many. They've morphed from logical devices to emotional devices, as one Japanese personal electronics executive puts it. Consumers now spend nearly as much on decorative and non-functional faceplates for their cell phones as they do on the phones themselves. Last year, they purchased about $4 billion worth of ringtones. Indeed, one of design's most potent economic effects is this very capacity to create new markets, whether for ringtones, utensils, photovoltaic cells, or medical devices. The forces of abundance, Asia, and automation turn goods and services into commodities so quickly that the only way to survive is by constantly developing new innovations, inventing new categories, and giving the world something it didn't know it was missing. Designing our future. Design can do more than supply our kitchens with cooking implements that stir both our sauces and our souls. Good design can change the world. And so, alas, can bad design. Take healthcare. Most hospitals and doctor's offices are not exactly repositories of charm and good taste. And while physicians and administrators might favor changing that state of affairs, they generally consider it secondary to the more pressing matters of prescribing drugs and performing surgery. But a growing body of evidence is showing that improving the design of medical settings helps patients get better faster. For example, in a study at Pittsburgh's Montefiore Hospital, surgery patients in rooms with ample natural light required less pain medication and their drug costs were 21% lower than their counterparts in traditional rooms. Another study compared two groups of patients who suffered identical ailments. One group was treated in a dreary, conventional ward of the hospital. The other was treated in a modern, sunlit, visually appealing ward. Patients in the better designed ward needed less pain medication than those in the less inviting ward and were discharged, on average, nearly 2 days early. Many hospitals are now redesigning their facilities to include greater amounts of natural light, waiting rooms that provide both privacy and comfort, and an array of design features such as meditative gardens and labyrinths that physicians now realize can speed the healing process. Similar potential exists in bringing a new design sensibility to two other settings where beauty has long taken a backseat to bureaucracy: public schools and public housing. A study at Georgetown University found that even if the students, teachers, and educational approach remain the same, improving a school's physical environment could increase test scores by as much as 11%. Meanwhile, public housing, notorious for its abominable aesthetics, may be in the very early stages of a renaissance. A nice example is architect Louise Braverman's Chelsea Court in New York City. Constructed with an austere budget, the building has colorful stairwells, airy apartments, and a roof deck with Philippe Starck furniture, all for tenants who are low-income or formerly homeless. Design can also deliver environmental benefits. The green design movement is incorporating the principles of sustainability in the design of consumer goods. This approach not only creates products from recycled materials, but also designs the products with an eye to their eventual disposal as well as their use. Architecture is likewise going green, in part because architects and designers are understanding that in the United States, buildings generate as much pollution as autos and factories combined. More than 1,100 buildings in the United States have applied to the U.S. Green Building Council to be certified as environmentally friendly. If you're still unconvinced that design can have consequences beyond the carport and the cutting board, point your memory back to the 2000 U.S. presidential elections and the 36-day snarl over whether Al Gore or George W. Bush won the most votes in Florida. That election and its aftermath may seem like a bad dream today, but buried in that brouhaha was an important and mostly ignored lesson. Democrats alleged that the U.S. Supreme Court, by halting the recount of ballots, handed the election to George W. Bush. Republicans claimed that their opponents tried to steal the election by urging voting officials to count CHADs, those little rectangular ballot pieces that were not fully punched out. But the truth is that both sides were wrong. According to an exhaustive examination of all of Florida's ballots that several newspapers and academics conducted a year after the election, what determined who won the U.S. presidency in the year 2000 was something else: the butterfly ballot. That's the ballot that voters in Palm Beach County used to mark their choice for president. If you've forgotten what it looks like, put the words butterfly ballot into a search engine and you'll get a photo very quickly. In Palm Beach County, a heavily Democratic enclave populated by tens of thousands of elderly Jewish voters, ultra-conservative fringe candidate Pat Buchanan received 3,407 votes, three times as many votes as he did in any other county in the state. According to one statistical analysis, if the voting pattern of the state's other 66 counties had held in Palm Beach, Buchanan would have won only 603 votes. What's more, 5,237 Palm Beach County voters marked ballots for both Al Gore and Pat Buchanan, and therefore had their ballots invalidated. Bush carried the entire state by 537 votes. What explained Buchanan's stunning performance in the thousands of invalidated ballots? Bad design. The nonpartisan investigation found that what decided the outcome in Palm Beach County, and therefore determined who would become leader of the free world, wasn't an evil Supreme Court or uncooperative CHADs. It was bad design. The bewildering butterfly ballot confused thousands of voters and cost Gore the presidency, according to the professor who headed the project. He says, "Voters' confusion with ballot instruction and design and voting machines appears to have changed the course of U.S. history." Had Palm Beach County had a few artists in the room when it was designing its ballot, the course of U.S. history would likely have been different. Now, intelligent people can argue whether the butterfly ballot and the confusion it wrought ultimately produced a good or bad result for the country. And this isn't partisan sniping from somebody, full disclosure, who worked for Al Gore a decade ago and who remains a registered Democrat. Bad design could have worked to Democrats' advantage and Republicans' chagrin, and one day it likely will. But whatever our own partisan persuasion, we should consider the butterfly ballot the conceptual age equivalent of the Sputnik launch. It was a surprising, world-changing event that revealed how weak Americans were in what we'd now discovered was a fundamentally important strength: design. Design is a high-concept aptitude that is difficult to outsource or automate, and that increasingly confers a competitive advantage in business. Good design, now more accessible and affordable than ever, also offers us a chance to bring pleasure, meaning, and beauty to our lives. But most important, cultivating a design sensibility can make our small planet a better place for us all. To be a designer is to be an agent of change, says Barbara Chandler Allen of the Charter High School for Architecture of Design. Think of how much better the world is going to be when these kids pour into the world. Design Portfolio. Now that we've talked a little bit about design, here are some ways to enhance your own design abilities. Keep a design notebook. Buy a small notebook and begin carrying it with you wherever you go. When you see great design, make a note of it. One example, my $6.95 hotspot silicone trivet, a thin, flexible square that doubles as a potholder, triples as a jar opener, and looks cool. Do the same for flawed design. Example, the hazard light button in my car, which is so close to the gear shift that I often turn on the hazards when I put the car in park. Before long, you'll be looking at graphics, interiors, environments, and much more with greater acuity, and you'll understand in a deeper way how design decisions shape our everyday lives. Be sure to include the design of experiences as well. Buying a cup of coffee, taking a trip on an airplane, going to an emergency room. If you're not a note taker, carry around a small digital camera or camera cell phone instead and snap photos of good and bad design. Here's another, which comes from Stefan Sagmeister, the graphic design impresario. He calls it Channel Your Annoyance. Step 1. Choose a household item that annoys you in any way. Step 2. Go by yourself to a cafe with pen and paper, but without a book and without a newspaper, and for the duration of your cup of coffee, think about improving the poorly designed item. Step 3. Send the idea or sketch as it is to the manufacturer of your annoying household item. You never know what might come of it. Here's a third way to get better at design. Read design magazines. Professional designers read and obsess over design magazines. So should you, except for the obsess part. Reading design magazines or just leafing through them can sharpen your eye and inspire your mind. While hundreds of design magazines fill the newsstands, these 8 are on my must-read list. 1. Ambidextrous. A project of Stanford University's D School, this quirky magazine explores the craft of design and the nuances of design thinking. You can find out more on the web at www.ambidextrousmag.com. 2. Dwell. One of the most respected shelter magazines, Dwell has an ethic of public service and environmental responsibility that helps it stand out. More information at www.dwellmag.com. 3. How. This terrific magazine mostly focuses on graphic design. It also has lots of smart business advice, reading recommendations, and an annual design competition that's a great source of ideas. More information at www.howdesign.com. 4. ID. This award-winning magazine is well known for its annual design review, which singles out the year's best designs, and for the ID 40, which introduces readers to up-and-coming designers. More information at www.idonline.com. 5. Metropolis. With a strong emphasis on construction and materials, this magazine offers tremendous insight into the built environment. I also like its coverage of sustainable design. More information at www.metropolismag.com. 6. O Magazine. Oprah Winfrey's publication, which bears its creator's design sensibility, is one of my 3 favorite magazines of any kind. Period. Read it, know it, live it. More information at www.oprah.com/omagazine. 7. Print. Another great graphic design magazine. This one is known for its voluminous regional design annual. More information, www.printmag.com. 8. Real Simple. One designer I know calls this magazine her Bible. Its theology is straightforward. To bring clarity to everyday tasks, so readers can focus on what really adds meaning to their lives. More information at www.realsimple.com. Another way to sharpen your design abilities: become a design detective. It's a favorite hobby of the real estate obsessed and the just plain nosy, visiting open houses. Follow their example and spend a Sunday walking through other people's homes. Scour the real estate ads in search of residences likely to yield an eclectic mix of design ideas and insights. Tour a half dozen homes and look for design trends and commonalities, as well as unique or quirky expressions of the owner's personalities and tastes. Take a page from architect Sarah Suzanka, author of The Not-So-Big House, and notice what constitutes the spaces that feel good to you. Try to determine if they appeal on an emotional level or in a physical way, and try to articulate why. Perhaps turn this into a group outing by collecting several friends and heading off to different open houses. Gather at the end of the day to compare notes. And be sure to take advantage of decorator show homes and neighborhood house tours. They can provide a healthy dose of design diversity in just a few hours. The snooping approach can also work on the job. Next time you're at someone else's workplace, look around. How does the physical environment make you feel? Would you be productive and happy in this kind of setting? How do the layout, lighting, and the furniture enhance or impede how people interact and communicate? What design elements would you incorporate into your own workplace? Another suggestion: crapify your graphic design. C-R-A-P-ify your graphic design. Robin Williams, no, not that one, is one of today's best design writers. Her book, The Non-Designer's Design Book, Design and Typography Principles for the Visual Novice, is a gem, in no small measure because she spells out the four basics of effective graphic design: contrast, repetition, alignment, and proximity, C-R-A-P. Contrast. If the elements, type, color, size, line thickness, shape, space, etc., are not the same, make them very different. Repetition. Repeating visual elements helps develop organization and strengthens the unity of your brochure, newsletter, or letterhead. Alignment. Nothing should be placed on the page arbitrarily. Every element should have some visual connection with another element on the page. Proximity. Items relating to each other should be grouped close together. Check out Williams' book for more examples. If you heed her C, R, A, and P, you'll avoid printed materials that look like not very good. There's more information at www.ratz.com. Here's another, this one from Dan Buchner, Director of Industrial Design at Design Continuum. Put it on a table. Find an object in your life that holds a special place in your heart. An old shirt from your college days, a perfectly butt-conforming wallet, a favorite serving spoon, a cool new watch. Place it on a table in front of you or hold it in your hand. Then explore the following questions. When you look at or use this object, what does it make you think of? Past experiences, the skill with which you can use it, the person who made it? There will be some satisfying experience or feeling that you may be able to uncover. Then ask, how does this object affect each of your five senses? There will be a series of details or aspects of design that will trigger your senses. Finally, think of how you have connected the sensory clues you receive from the object to the way you think and feel about it. Can you see the connections you have made? Try this exercise with other objects, maybe objects that you don't have a particular connection with. What about these objects is different? Why don't they tickle the emotions? Developing the ability to consciously select designs that connect with our emotions should help us populate our lives with meaningful, satisfying objects and not just more stuff.